welcome to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. Join your hosts, Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter, as we create a brave space for conversations about racism, personal transformation, and accountability. Conversation provides a means to dive deeply into your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs, and examine what emerges in your words, actions, and behaviors. The show is a journey towards anti-racism by cultivating change within yourself first and then out into the world. Learn to engage in racial dialogue using four tools: courage, conversation, relationship, and accountability. Discover how truth, reconciliation, and healing can emerge from honest and deliberate conversations. Manifest social change right now on Inflection Point Podcast. Well, hello, hello, hello. I'm so happy to have you here with us for the newest episode of Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio. I am your host, Anita Russell, and here is a quick hello from Gail and Mavis, the two co-hosts. Gail, take it away.
Hi, I'm Gail Hunter, and welcome to our podcast. Go ahead, Mavis.
Hi, I'm Mavis Bauman. Welcome, welcome.
Excellent, excellent. So if you have been following us for the last couple of episodes or so, you know that we have been focusing on a particular topic. So that's generally how we do it. We focus on a certain topic, and then we have a central question associated with that topic. So the topic that we're focusing on, and this is our last part for this particular topic: racism is a disruptor of health and wellness in mind, body, and spirit. And our central question for today is, how do community-based solutions play a role in driving health equity? And throughout the conversation, the three of us are going to talk about some that question from specific topics that are related to social determinants of health. And we're also going to feature a particular community-based solution that we just wanted to highlight as an example of the type of work that people are actually out there doing. So just as a quick recap, the work that we've been discussing has been based on the 2017 publication from the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, and it's called Communities in Action, Pathways to Health, Communities in Action, Pathways to Health Equity. And there are a number of takeaways of that particular resource. And the four takeaways are: health equity is crucial to the well-being and vibrancy of communities. I'm sure we can all agree to that. Mm-hmm. Social inequities matter more than healthcare in shaping health disparities. Health equity holds benefits for the entire nation, from economic vitality to national security. And finally, communities have the power to take steps towards health equity. And so that's what we're talking about, is these community-based solutions. And that's kind of defined as an action or a policy or a program or a law that is driven by the community, that it impacts the community level factors and promotes health equity. So our discussion includes strategies of one particular community, the one that I mentioned earlier, and that one is called People United for Sustainable Housing in Buffalo, New York, and they refer to it as Push Buffalo. So we're going to refer to that particular community-based solution throughout our conversation. So the three social determinants of health that we're going to focus on, and these are actually the last three, there's a total of nine, and we've already talked about the other six. So we're ending out part three by talking about the last three, which are income and wealth, employment, housing. And each one of us is going to take one of those social determinants of health and expand upon it and talk a little bit about how Push Buffalo actually incorporates or reflects that particular social determinant. So I'm going to just jump right in and talk about income and wealth. Now, I think the times that we're living in, those are things that people are kind of concerned about on a regular basis now. When you think about the fact that we just, you know, what we just went through with COVID, and you saw some shifting dynamics in there with regard to employment. You have a number of people who lost their jobs. You have a number of people who move into remote working and all that sort of thing. And then as things are starting to kind of wind down, at least in terms of people moving around a little bit more, people are actually quitting. And people are quitting for various reasons. Some of the reasons that I've read about are people just kind of deciding, you know what, I really just don't want to do that anymore. I want to have my own business. Or, you know, people just came to this conclusion like, you know, I was really unhappy in that work, so I'm not going to go back. Or I like to have the option of not working 5 days a week in the office, but maybe only working 3 days in the week. So people kind of came out of it just kind of in this mindset centered around flexibility and having more options. And now there's a huge demand because you have so many people that have left their jobs, which is opening up lots and lots of work. And so now there's an employment shortage. You know, so it's interesting how those things play together. But in all of that, one of the things that people also were kind of thinking about, well, you know, I could maybe make more money if I leave this space that I'm in and go to this space over here, whether that's getting starting my own business or going to another company or what have you. So when you think about income and defined as the amount of money earned in a single year from, and it can be from your employment, government assistance, retirement, pension, interest, dividends, investments, and all of those different types of things that kind of make up the income portion of your financial picture. So I look at myself as a little bit of an example. I went to the University of Pittsburgh, graduated as a science major, and ended up starting a research career. Now, when I started my career, I didn't have any children. I was fresh out of college, and I was just glad to be able to say that I went to college and I was able to find a job right after college. So that was a blessing in and of itself. But this, I started working in an academic research environment, actually was connected to the University of Pittsburgh. However, as my career progressed and I started thinking more and more and more about other ways that I could do research in other environments. And so I started researching the pharmaceutical industry, which was good because it definitely opened up a lot more possibilities for me from a career perspective. I could make more money. The catch was there's no pharmaceutical industry in the city of Pittsburgh, which is where I was at that time. There's no pharmaceutical industry here. So in order for me to be able to get on a different path from an income perspective, I needed to make a big move. And so I packed myself up. At the time I had my first daughter, we got ourselves packed up and we moved to the New Jersey area. And I ended up getting a job, working a job in Princeton University, in the city of Princeton with one of the pharmaceutical companies that's there. And so I was able to make that type of decision in regards to my income. But there's a lot of people out there who are not necessarily in that position to be able to do that. And so that's where this conversation is really about. How do we make things a little bit more equitable so that everybody has more of a chance of surviving and thriving from an income perspective? The other piece of it is wealth or economic assets that you accumulate over the course of time. So you think about income in terms of what you're gaining in a single year, But then when you think about wealth or economic assets, that happens over the course of time. And it can even happen generationally. So if you look at some of the more wealthier individuals in our population who may have had wealth as part of their family legacy for generations. And some of those generations, that legacy of wealth actually traces back to enslavement as well. And so there's all of these different ways now of looking at wealth. And then you have other people that are gaining more wealth because they're starting their own business. They're going into, you know, a lot more people are sort of going on this entrepreneur route. And so you have some people that do the really big entrepreneur thing, like I want to have a multi-million dollar company. I want to grow the company and then I want to flip it, so to speak, and sell it and then kind of start that process. Start that process all over again. So those are people that are kind of like serial entrepreneurs. I've heard that term. You may have heard that term. Mm-hmm. And there are also people such as myself who did the corporate career, made a decision that I didn't want to do that anymore, that I wanted to have my own business, but I wasn't looking at it from the standpoint of having this, you know, this big corporation and all of that. I was much more interested in helping people more on a one-to-one basis. And so I ended up founding my business that's a life coaching practice in that. So the point being able to make those types of decisions that are going to impact your income in the short term, if you will, but then also impact your wealth and your economic assets over the long term. And so the more access you have to be able to make those types of choices, mm-hmm. the better off your life can be, your family, you know, the things that you do for leisure. And when you think about these four things, where you live, where you learn, where you work, and where you play, all of those factors are really related to the thing that I'm discussing right now, which is income. Everybody needs to have some sort of income in order for them to, the idea is that everybody should have some baseline minimal way of living so that you don't have people that are up here and then people, you know, that are way down here, like below zero and that sort of thing. So that becomes really, really problematic. So then when you start looking at organizations that are out there that are actually doing things to impact people in their economic lives, you know, and can start helping them to kind of generate wealth, having steady employment and all of that. So I'm going to share a little bit with you about Push Buffalo. This organization is located in Buffalo, New York. It was founded in 2005 by a gentleman by the name of Aaron Bartley and Eric Walker. So their mission, just listen to this. Their mission is to mobilize residents to create strong neighborhoods with quality, affordable housing, to expand local hiring opportunities. So there you go. It's feeding right into this issue of income and to advance economic and environmental justice. And so the economic justice part of it relates directly to having access to those things that enable you to actually build wealth. And so when I, you know, when we were doing all of the research and kind of getting an idea of, because we had like a number of different community-based organizations to kind of select from, but this particular one seems to really cover like almost all of the 9 social determinants of health. So we decided to take a little bit of a deep dive into that one. So I'm just going to read one more thing about that, and then I'm going to turn it. I'm going to turn it over to Gail. So maybe we'll have like a minute or two just to discuss it. I want to make sure that I'm not running in too much into Gail's time. So one of their strategies is to build a more democratic, action-oriented organization that addresses poor housing conditions and the lack of living wage jobs in mm-hmm. our neighborhoods. That's mm-hmm. a powerful yeah. statement. that really speaks to this whole thing that we're talking about in this moment right now around the income and wealth building. So any thoughts from Gail and Mavis before we flip it over to Gail?
It's they're all crucial issues, right? It's and every one of them just one's as important as the other one. But to have the income and to have the housing availability that's sustainable are crucial elements that need to be present. And it's not always present for people.
I just love the idea of finding solutions within a community instead of bringing them from the outside. You can imagine that you're going to get much different investment from local people. You're going to cut down their expense of even going to the to a job if it's closer. People will know each other. Getting hired will be easier because there's a certain amount of trust within communities. I just love this idea of taking what's there and building from it instead of someone coming from the outside and doing the whole gentrification process. And displacing all these people who really could use the community help. So I just think it's fabulous, especially with respect to income and wealth building. I read that some of them are able to just stay in their houses. The houses were being improved instead of things being torn down. All of those things just seem like such positive solutions and not complicated.
Exactly. And it breeds it breeds pride.
Good point.
Self-esteem and pride.
I was
amazed to understand that the push is actually membership, that people join this and that you can bring to this organization a problem and they together collectively will try to resolve it and use whatever resources they can within the organization. And because so there are different branches that have branched off from push, but are still connected to them.
So at this point, I'm actually going to pass the mic over to you, Gail, so you can continue and you're going to talk about housing as a social determinant of health.
Right. Housing as a social determinant of health refers to the availability or lack of availability of high quality, safe and affordable housing for residents of various incomes. I have to share something with you that today as a psychotherapist, I was talking to somebody new that I just met today. And put this in perspective when what we're talking about. She's a 44-year-old woman who had 7 children. 2 of them have died. She just lost her job today. She has to move out of her house that is falling apart. And she did qualify for Section 8 housing, which is a lower income housing. But she still has to now come up with $980. I mean, that's a lot of money, right? And then she has to find another job right away in order to make sure she's continuing to able to pay for that. And she has to find movers. I mean, so think about that. And her 15-year-old daughter has been missing for 2 weeks. I mean, so there are all complicated issues going on just within this one moment, this one point of time in her day, right? And so housing is crucial. She doesn't even know how she's going to move out of this house, let alone to get to the next one, right? And so all those different things that we just take for granted. You know, I was thinking about just my own home that if I were to stop really working, I might not be able to stay here. And I would have to then adjust and be able to find something I could afford to live in within this at a much lower income. And the transition that would be difficult for me. But there are people there that are living with this all their lives, right? And so housing also, it encompasses the density within a housing unit, segregation and diversity in the area, the overall level of segregation, of racial bias and ethnic classifications that often happen. It affects our physical health conditions, such as lead and different allergens, molds. I mean, and they really do play havoc on our physical health. It's one of the best researched social determinants of health. Housing is, and selected housing interventions for low-income people have been found to improve health outcomes and decrease healthcare costs considerably. In 2005, WHO, the World Health Organization, found that sufficient evidence that stated that available to estimate the burden of disease for different physical factors, such as extreme temperatures, chemical factors, such as environmental tobacco smoke, if you're in an apartment building and that the ventilation is going to put that smoke everywhere. lead, if the pipe systems are not functioning well, there could be lead in the pipes, not just in the paint and the walls that have been mostly removed or trying to be mostly removed. And the biological factors such as mold and dust mites, as I mentioned before, the mold. There are also physical parts of the building. If they're not safe, if they're not kept up to standards, there could be a lot more injuries and accidents happening. So there needs to be a continuation of more clarity in some of the requirements and the relationship between health and housing. Most Americans spend about 90% of their time indoors, and about two-thirds of that time is spent in the home. And young children spend even more time at home, and they're very, especially very vulnerable to different household hazards that are really not even necessarily in the family's power to change. It's not like leaving chemicals in the kitchen that a child could get to. It could just be literally from what's going on in the building itself. If there are water leaks, there's poor ventilation, their carpets are dirty, there's pest infestation, bed bugs. Then when that comes into one apartment in an apartment building, they travel to every single apartment, and it's really difficult to get, not impossible, but difficult to get rid of. So it's even things like that you have no control over. Then we know that different issues that I've brought up, like lead poisoning, can cause irreversible effects on the brain and nervous system. Cold indoors and a variation in temperature from one extreme to the other has been associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease and also a higher mortality among more vulnerable populations, such as the elderly, which I've now joined. And there's even residential crowding. You'll see a lot of families that have multiple families living in one unit, that they may have two bedrooms and they have 10 people in that apartment. And how that can affect everyone. There's also an increased risk of developing respiratory problems and even tuberculosis. And they're finding that the stress levels are much higher. And for children, it's more difficult for them to find places that they can study, to be able to have their own bedrooms, that they often will share bedrooms. And it's difficult to emotionally, not just physically, experience living in those kind of conditions. You see a lot of people that are immigrants, that you'll see families joining together and living in a smaller place because of financial reasons, right? And they do the best that they can. But something more needs to be happening, I think, to help. Housing is considered affordable when a family spends less than 30% of its income to rent or buying or owning a residence. The shortage of affordable housing limits families and individuals' choices about where they can even live. It usually means to relegate lower income families to substandard housing and unsafe and overcrowded neighborhoods with higher rates of poverty, of fewer resources for health promotion, and such as with parks and places that you can ride bikes or recreation areas, community centers. High housing related costs place a particular economic burden on low income families, forcing trade-offs between, do I buy food? Do I pay my heating bill? Or what do I really put this money towards? They found low-income people had a difficulty paying rent, mortgage, or utility bills, and often they would forego medical, regular doctor checkups and end up going into the emergency rooms and using that as their way of getting medical help. As I said before, poor housing can also affect children and their academic abilities. It can, if steps and windows and balconies are not safe and secure, people can fall. There have been children falling out of windows. There have been, different things that people just walking down the steps and a step giving out glass or so forth that can break very easily. So there's also a high level correlation with depression and anxiety that they notice also in some of the studies. So the inadequate plumbing and lack of air conditioning is really a major health issue for people. Think about some of the really hot days, and since our climate is changing somewhat, we've had some pretty hot summers and temperatures, and people that don't have air conditioning, especially older people or people with respiratory failure or difficulties, they have a very difficult time getting through that. And there have been deaths because of that. So that's an issue that is not affordable to many people. They also listed stress from living in an area where there might be violence, and how stressful that is on children and adults both, and how feeling unsafe. So there's quite a few determinants and issues that really come up with housing that really do need to be addressed and continue to be addressed.
Thank you for that, Gail. So there is a couple of things that I wanted to kind of comment on. Number one, everything that you just said describes that very intimate, if you will, connection between housing and income. Like you just can't, the two are just inseparable, so to speak. And then you had also mentioned the tie of money and health, right? I'm sorry, the tie between housing and health. But then one of the problems that I see that we have is that there's also a very strong tie between money and housing. So when you think about it from a development perspective, from developers, you know, building new, like we were talking about the file cabinet apartments and, and all of that. So you have the developers that have a very capitalistic, money-oriented mindset
per square foot, right?
But then you're impacting these individuals. And I wanted to share one quick story. We got about three more minutes until we go to break. But one quick story that I saw very recently, and it was on the housing crisis that we're in right now, right? As a result of COVID, housing prices are through the roof, particularly with rental properties. Landlords are doubling and tripling their rents, which means you're knocking people out. So it was a an instance where it's a woman that lives in Florida. I believe it's her and her daughter. She has a very nice home. It's not, you know, it doesn't have any of the issues with the, you know, the environment or the plumbing. She has a beautiful home. But she's low income and she gets a government voucher. And so she is 100% dependent upon the government voucher in addition to whatever other income that, you know, she has. But she needs that government voucher in order for her to sustain herself. So she recently got a letter from the landlord saying her rent for the space had gone up to like over $2,000. Just like that. And now she's wondering, what in the world am I supposed to do? None of those other issues were there. It's a beautiful property, well-maintained, but that link to income and also that link from housing and money is what drives some of these problems and all of that. So Mavis, if you wanted to comment, I think we got about two more minutes before we go to break.
Yeah, as I was listening to Gail, I just thought of the cascade of problems that come from people not having, I saw this term today, a family raising wage. If you don't have a living wage for yourself or a family raising wage, all of those things are going to happen. You're not going to be able to repair where you live. You're not going to be able to get into a good building. You're not going to have any leverage with your landlord. I mean, all of those things come together. And then I think what falls out of all of this is, where's the humanity for people who need a place to live? There's no place for them to go. And, you know, it's just, I remember a friend of mine saying, we're really all one paycheck away from being homeless. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just not that far from a catastrophic event that would really change our housing situation. So all of those things come together if you don't have a living wage.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we are pretty much at that point where it's time for us to take a break, and we'll come right back and we'll continue the conversation.
Are you wanting more for your life? Are you ready to create your life with confidence and contribution? We all have a gift to give to the world. Becoming you is that gift. In order to truly live your life, you have to become you on purpose and with intention. Leah Rowling supports you in becoming you using the B Method, consistently producing results for hundreds of entrepreneurs and business owners. For more information, visit leahrowling.com.
You've been listening, but are you watching? Tune in to your favorite shows on the Transformation Talk Radio Facebook page. We stream live video podcasts every day, and we love to hear from you. Leave comments and questions for the host to address live, on the air, and get to know the faces behind the voices you love. Just go to Facebook and search for Transformation Talk Radio.
Yeah, yippee skippy to that, baby.
Courtney Cottrell is walking in her purpose, creating incredible tools to level up your life. Let's introduce you to the Unapologetically Favored Gift Shop, your one-stop shop for all Courtney's motivational books, custom created, inspirational gifts, and more. Products that remind you of your purpose on this planet, infused with the passion to uplift lives. Shop apparel, books, wall art, and more at shopfavored.net.
Join the new earth on the Cornelia Stephanie Show. Tune in each month as Cornelia takes listeners on an odyssey of higher consciousness to inspire, educate, and empower. Cornelia Stephanie is a spiritual teacher, passionate speaker, published author, and founder of the Empower Network. Cornelia guides people on the path of self-healing, peace, and liberation. For more information, go to corneliastephanie.com.
Do you question what an authentic life really looks like? Tune in to The Alley Effect with Allison Blythe, authentically living life your way. Every first and third Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com, where Allison Blythe brings you tools, resources, and actionable steps toward your very best life. Take responsibility for your own happiness. For more about Allison, visit Allison, A-L-L-Y-S-O-N, Blythe, B-L-Y-T-H-E.com.
So welcome back. You are listening to Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio. And our topic is racism is a disruptor of health and wellness. And our central question for this episode is, how do community-based solutions play a role in driving health equity? And at this point, I'm going to pass the mic over to Mavis, and she's going to bring us home with that final topic.
Great. Thanks, Anita. I've been a quote collector for years, and I collected something when I was like about 19 years old. And the quote is, "It's a darn good day when a man can get up, put on his shoes, and go to work." And I think about the importance of just our identity when we have a job, to be able to have purpose, to support our families, to have an economic role in our community. And I just think that everyone should have this opportunity, no matter their race, educational level, geographic area, physical abilities, all of those things. But unfortunately, these work opportunities are not evenly distributed, either geographically or socioeconomically. So, and it's especially true for people of color. I remember hearing recently that resume algorithms can even discriminate against Black names, which blows my mind. And so there's even a process that Black people know they have to do to, quote unquote, whiten their resume a little bit in order to get a job, which that's got to end and soon. So anyway, I just took a look at this idea of workplace and how it affects our health from two different angles. One is just getting in and getting a job. And then the other angle is, what are the workplace conditions? Are you safe, you know, emotionally, mentally, physically, and so on? I happened to find this report from McKinsey. They did some a study with some serious data points, 24 companies representing 3.7 million employees in the United States. And one of the quotes from their report says, "Inequality is baked deep into our current capitalist society." Ouch. That's big. That's deep and broad. It says many researchers see these challenges as rooted in the socioeconomic and racial history of the United States. Achieving equity for Black workers in the private sector requires addressing certain challenges, including geography, industry, job type, and so on. And companies need to work with each other to address these hurdles for people of color. They came up with 10 key challenges in private companies, and I wanted to just highlight three of them. One is the underrepresentation of Black workers in the faster growing industries. Another one is the disproportionate impact of technology and the future of work on Black workers. And the third is a trust deficit among Black employees toward their companies. So all of those challenges are kind of come out of the fact that Black people are overrepresented in our frontline jobs. So if we look at the time of COVID in particular, these were the people that had to go to work. They're working in transportation, they're working in hospitality and food service. Those frontline people, not the C-suite people, but the frontline people. And so they were disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. There was a higher rate of death, higher rate of sickness, and so on in the Black community. We need to realize, like, what would we do without these people that are willing, at least for now, to take these jobs? They're overrepresented in low-wage occupations and underrepresented in high-wage occupations. And then, Anita, I think, as you mentioned today, the pipeline for promotion of work is broken. It's just broken. Get a load of this. Today, there are 4 Black CEOs in Fortune 500 companies. If Black people were proportionately represented in these Fortune 500 companies, there would be 60, not 4, but 60. That is the depth of that disproportionate representation. And, you know, you just have to wonder why at this point, why are we still here? Another term that I saw that I thought was interesting was an emotional tax that occurs for people that probably mainly people of color. Yeah, they're talking about Black employees here, but a heightened feeling of being different that has a detrimental effect on the health of Black employees. You know, just probably a certain anxiety level, like, what's going to happen in this meeting with all white people in the room? What am I free to say? What must I not say? How can I be myself? They did comment at the end of their report that things are getting better, but at the rate they're improving in terms of bringing back Black people into higher level positions, raising wages, and so on, it would take 95 years for Black employees to reach a talent parity with white people. 95 years. Yeah. Okay. And McKinsey says that if companies followed their recommendations, they could bring that parity into place within about 25 years. Still, that's a long time, because we're going to end racism before that, right?
Yeah, we got to do it in 15.
We got to do it in 15 right. years, right? Right. But you see that the workplace is kind of holding on to that systemic racism, right, throughout. Whether it's the physical place that they work. I found one example just to drive home the point about Black workers being our frontline workers. This is something that happened in the around 1927, where they were digging a tunnel in order to reroute a river. Black workers represented less than 20% of the local population, but 76% of the estimated 700 workers who died as a direct result of the dry drilling technique were Black. And, you know, these people were not given masks to prevent the silica from going into their lungs. So they got silicosis. They died, whether it, even if it wasn't from an accident. They worked 10 to 15 hour days, got the job done in half the time, but still many of them died from these lingering illnesses. Some of them, it says, were forced at gunpoint to keep working longer hours.
And that sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yes.
Far away, I mean, slavery,
cattle right? slavery.
This is just, yes, exactly. Right. This is just an extension right. of slavery. Right. Because again, the white managers, owners of the company had all the power. And these people had come from different parts of the country. You know, this was the major depression, and these people needed jobs, and they retreated as expendable objects and not as humans with lives and families and people who were depending on them. So that really hit me hard to see how, just again, about this loss of humanity for Black workers. I saw where they finally put up a memorial for these workers in 2009. They could not be buried at the time they died next to a white cemetery. Mm-hmm. So they were buried near miners. I mean, this sort of historical fact is just shameful and has to change. But the bottom line here is that this country was really built on free labor. It started out that way. You know, slavery was how we really built our original wealth in this country. And, you know, the proportion of our sales and exports that were cotton is, I had no idea that it was that disproportionate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're still working with bringing everyone into our economy with a specific role. You know, relating to this PUSH organization, this is very cool. I didn't get to spend as much time with this as I would have liked, but this PUSH organization goes right in the community to solve a lot of these work issues. For example, they're hiring people within the community to build these green zones, these green homes. They're training them on the job. Very cool. Nobody has to go anywhere else to pay extraordinary tuition to go and learn to do the jobs. The organization is standing behind the employees so that if they are hired by an outside company and they have, let's say, a prison background or something, the PUSH organization, if I'm not mistaken, stands behind the employee. So in other words, for a person with a prison background, it's just next to impossible to get a job, right? You know, and they've got this sort of community support to get work and to break through that. Let's see, what else do I have here? This particular community says it's living the bounds of this zone. People roughly made $20,000 with 40% of the residents, and 60% of the children are living in poverty. This is the type of community that city planning processes do not serve. So the idea of this PUSH organization coming and targeting a specific area like this just to me seems just, I don't know, exciting and wonderful to acknowledge the humanity in that space instead of the capitalist model, which is, it just doesn't make sense monetarily. Right. Let's just tear these homes down, exactly. You know. Right. Instead, let's go. These people are here. They want to work. They can work. They can be trained. Right. Do you want to interject something there?
Well, I was just going to say, even if, you know, even if it is a situation where, let's say, housing development really does need to be torn down, it's like some of the things that Gail sure. was pointing out. Mm-hmm. But the developers should be sitting at the table with yeah. the people that are going to be yes. most impacted by right. whatever that change exactly. ends up being. That is the human way of doing
yes.
it. But to your point,
yes.
we've gotten so to the point where we're so driven by the dollar.
Yes.
that were literally willing to compromise people's lives in order for me to get the dollar. That's shameful.
It's just shameful.
It is
shameful. As a society, as a human race, it's just...
Right.
And you know, when we do that, then all these other costs of having done that bubble up. Like Gail was mentioning, the cost of extra health care needed because these people are living in unhealthy environments. All of those things come back to get you.
Right. And you know, it comes back and it impacts everybody.
Everybody.
It doesn't just impact wherever that problem is localized. It impacts the whole entire imagery of the United States.
Right.
And the more we keep letting it go, the more it's the weight of all of that is just going to keep on bringing things
down.
And it's
just precious.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
So we're like in this time right now that we need to be collectively working together to figure out how we can solve some of these problems. So I have a little bit of a quote here, and this is from the Communities in Action, the resource that we've been using.
Mm-hmm.
Healthier, more equitable communities in which individuals and families live, learn, work, and play appear at the center of the work that they do as the outcome of community-driven solutions. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that model, it's the community-driven solutions that are really doing so much to drive this sort of in a more positive kind of going forward.
Humane way.
Exactly. Where everybody can benefit. And I think also we move away from this mindset that zero sum kind of looking at everything, where if I lose, if somebody else wins, that means I have to lose something. Yeah. No, it doesn't.
It
means you both can win.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means. But it's going to take changing our consciousness and changing our mindsets, like that whole cultivating change from the inside out is what it's going to take, because we cannot keep thinking and being the way that we are. We're just going to destroy ourselves. And I can honestly say, you know, Black folks, we're at the point where it's like, no more. Enough is enough.
Enough is enough. Amen. I was just going to make one other point that excited me about this PUSH organization. The idea that they are almost starting fresh with this green zone idea. Mm-hmm. So they're bringing in new technology. They're not training local residents on, you know, how to put in oil heaters or something. They're preparing them for the future, and they're doing things that are kind to the earth, which is another thing that's going to push that ball forward for protecting our health. So these communities can be a part of moving us forward on so many different levels, instead of just being pushed aside and destroyed, really.
Right.
Yeah, and I love what you said, Anita, about them being at the table. They know.
And that's crucial. I think that's crucial to what's going on with PUSH and how they're being so successful, is that they're letting the people in the community themselves be at the core of building this, and being at the core of maintaining it too. That they train people to maintain the green spaces that they've developed, and they're using it to build water retention things in the green spaces and for the houses. And so it's filtering out and affecting also so many different parts of the economy of and the structure of the city itself, but it's coming from the community itself, from the group of people who live and reside there, right?
That and that goes back to that pride issue. Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I did this and I'm going to protect it.
Right, exactly.
And I think another thing that what you just pointed out, Gail, is the talent is there.
It's there. But nobody has turned around and noticed it or encouraged it or supported it or educated it.
Right.
It's there. It's so much there.
Absolutely. So we are quickly running out of time. And one of the things that I wanted you all to do is have the opportunity to kind of call out the work that you do outside of Inflection Point Podcast, give people the opportunity to visit your website and see on, you know, all the stuff you got going on outside of this podcast.
So who goes first?
Mavis.
So my main project is called Seed a Better Life. It's a nonprofit. You've heard me mention it a little bit before. It is an organization that raises funds for the support of Rwandan genocide survivors. And I was just thinking about how to tie that work in with this conversation. One thing that we have done from the very beginning is, what do you need? What do you need? Where does this child want to go to school? Which child in the family wants to go to school? We've tried very hard not to be prescriptive so that we don't interrupt the natural flow of things. If the oldest child, for example, wants to go to school, they're very likely to share what they learn with the younger kids. Those things come from the parents, if they have them, or the kids. They tell us what they need, what their dreams are, and their investment in their education that we're paying for is enormous. So I was thinking too about, you know, why should anybody go to my website and take a look and donate for that matter? All of the funds so far have gone for the benefit of these kids. We've provided help in some form for over 140 kids at this point. It's not huge. It's not like, CARE or United Way, but we are very connected to these kids. We get to know all of their stories, and we cry with them when family members pass. We celebrate their weddings with them, their graduations. It's just a lovely gathering of people. So that website is seedabetterlife.org. Thank you for listening to that story. Okay, yeah. Who's next?
I'll go next. Well, I am a psychotherapist in private practice as my day job, but I also am the president of the board of OMA, Pittsburgh OMA Center for Mind, Body, and Spirit. And OMA started out doing it's a nonprofit. We're a working volunteer board. We started out doing a lecture series once or twice a month, and we highlight practitioners and people that are into topics that are under mind, body, and spirit. We have a day program that, I don't know what happened to my watch, sorry. We have a program during the summer for youth in the city, and it's in a garden, and it's just an amazing program, and it helps kids learn more about the environment and STEM issues, and also it's very trauma-informed, and we offer a trauma-informed training to the teachers and socially emotionally based education. And so it's really an amazing program that we offer for 6 weeks during the summer, and over half of the positions that for kids are given to low income families, and that's one program that's really doing well, and we could easily expand it even more. The other thing we do is a trauma informed that's based in trauma. We do something called You Are Not Alone. For once a month, we get together, a panel of us who are survivors of abuse, and we talk about different issues related to trauma and how we may have healed or how we could heal from certain things that have happened. And that's all types of trauma and ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. And a few other things we do in addition to that, but so I welcome you to join the website and register and get an understanding of what we're doing. It's under OMA, Pittsburgh.org. We're also doing a big fundraiser this year. We don't have a physical building yet, so we're going to do a big fundraiser trying to get money to come in to actually get a physical space too. So thank you.
And your programs are awesome, right, Anita?
I'm really out.
And he's on the board too. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say.
Oh, that's right.
It's a pleasure to be on the OMA board, number one, but it's also my pleasure to be able to present and facilitate in some of the training programs. So I've worked with the Art in the Garden program. I've done the trauma-informed care work. And I really would like call that website out one more time, Gail, because there's so much stuff that's going on right now that people may want to take advantage of. And then I'll tell you about what I do.
OMA Pittsburgh, O-M-A, Pittsburgh.org.
Excellent. Excellent. So I am the founder and CEO of a company called The Place to Soar. That is my heart. Everything that I do in my life is really centered around that. And what I do in my coaching practice is basically I create what I call bridge crossers. And so I have a tendency to kind of think of this, the work that I do in moving a person from where they are to where they desire to be as them crossing a bridge. And so I am their navigator as they're crossing their bridge. I can be their advisor as they're crossing their bridge. I'm helping them to discover what does that pathway across the bridge look like for them. And so every individual has their own bridge crossing experiences. And I you know, set it up deliberately that way. So the website for me is theplacetosoar.com. And that's soar, S-O-A-R, theplacetosoar.com. And so be sure that you go and visit all of the websites that we just called out. And also, if you go and look at our giveaway list, there are things listed on the giveaway list as well. So you definitely want to check that out. And I think I have like maybe another minute or two to go. So what I wanted to do was close everything out with this quote. We are at a critical point in history where enacting real policy change is not only important, but it's a central part of creating an equitable society for all. And that's really what our conversations have been about, is creating this equitable society for everybody. And that quote came from Rihanna Rogers. She's the director of the RAND Center for Advanced Racial Equity Policy. So you can look them up, go find out lots of stuff that they do. They do a lot of stuff in terms of research. So it's a wealth of information and all of that. And make sure you go visit the PUSH website. Oh my gosh, do I have time? It is pushbuffalo.org. So I wanted to make sure I called that out before we got kicked off of the program. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you next time on Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Thank you for listening to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. The journey towards anti-racism and social change doesn't stop here. Truth, reconciliation, and healing come from ongoing, open, honest, and deliberate conversations. Continue to dive in and deconstruct your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs as we band together to manifest social change. Tune in to Inflection Point Podcast every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on TransformationTalkRadio.com for more conversations about how we can cultivate change from the inside out.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.